For the week of May 5th, 2013, Cinco de Mayo, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 190, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, suffering from tree pollen allergies, I'm Michael Giltz.
Wait, you're suffering from allergies, except you live in New York? I didn't think they had trees in New York.
Apparently we do. There's Central Park, you know, we have trees. And I developed allergies as an adult, seasonal allergies. Apparently as a child, I was spending too much time watching movies and sitting in the library reading books. I was too neat and clean. I should have been outside trading germs and diseases with other little boys and girls so that I could build up my immune system.
Hey, this is a family show, okay? You can't be saying things like trading whatever you just said.
We do have families out there. So parents, if you have a child, grab them by the hand, pause the show, grab them by the hand, lead them outside, roll them in the dirt, and then send them off to play with the local ragamuffins, somebody like the Little Rascals. And trust me, 30 years from now, they'll thank you.
Yeah, I don't think they're going to remember 30 years from now.
Nah, they'll probably be living back at home.
Well, when I lived in New York, there were no trees. So that Rudolph Giuliani, he really did make a change in New York.
That's right. And we have a change, or at least a correction, to make about our show from last week.
Right. And you know what? I should say, you could follow us. And I'm going to get to this correction. But, you know, it was from a listener named Patrick Corcoran. He is the NATO vice president and chief communications officer. He was listening to the show and he had a correction for us because he listens to the show. And he can follow us, like all of you can, on Twitter, where we can be followed at Showbiz Sandbox is our username. In fact, that's our username on Facebook, where we have a page under Showbiz Sandbox. You can even email us, which I believe that's actually no. Patrick contacted us through Facebook, but you can email us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call us. Our number is 888-567-SAND. And that's for those out of the country. That's +1-888-567-7263. And we certainly appreciate all the feedback and letters and emails and Facebook comments that everybody posts. But Patrick was listening to the show last week, and we did mention NATO, the National Association of Theater Owners. And, well, let's just say he had a thing or two to say about a thing or two we reported last week.
That's right. First of all, he said that they were not interested in using the name Show West because they bought back the annual event that is held for theater owners and studios where they get together and share the upcoming movies. And they have their new version is called CinemaCon. And he pointed out that they didn't ask for the Show West name because they felt it was too tainted. They wanted to get a fresh start, a clean slate, and, you know, just a brand new launch of that product. And so that's why they chose CinemaCon rather than asking for Show West. They never even tried to get it.
Right. In fact, they didn't have to buy it back. The contract with Nielsen ended, and so they just decided to start holding their own convention. Now, he writes here about another topic we discussed. More.
Now, who said that they didn't want the Show West name or couldn't get it or it was too much money or somebody else had it? Who was that? Was that you or me? I can't remember.
That would have been me.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Okay, yeah. Let's keep going.
Yeah, I detect a trend here because he writes, more important, though, you are completely wrong about the average ticket price. Now, Michael, I have to tell our listeners here, when we always say we are going to give you the best, we're going to basically put our best efforts out. And when we are going to be wrong, we're not going to just be slightly wrong. We're going to be completely wrong, not just a little wrong. So he continues, it is the total dollars from all companies that respond divided by the number of tickets sold from all companies that responded. We do not take the average ticket price in Fargo and the average price in New York and divide by two.
Which, now, who would have said that?
That would have been, let's see, me.
Michael Sperling.
Yes. Eeny, meeny, miny, me. It was me. So he goes on to say, we make sure we get at least 60% of theater companies and include the top 10. If anything, the average is high since the companies and markets we don't get a response from are the smaller ones.
Well, that's a good point. You know, he has access to all the great info. I'd love to see like 3D wide releases, live action, how many tickets they're each selling year to year compared to the last year and the year before. You know, they can break down all that info to, you know, 8 Ways to Sunday. It'd be fascinating to get a look at what they're seeing.
Well, actually, we can talk to Patrick about that. Patrick Corcoran will be joining us on next week's show to talk about this very subject, so we can talk to him about it then.
Well, who's here on this week's show?
Well, funny you should mention that, because Ann Thompson, who is over at IndieWire and is our resident Oscar expert, she is going to be here to talk about some of the changes the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, you know, the Academy, they announced over the weekend some changes about the voting process for its little award show, a.k.a. the Oscars. The Rolling Stones kicked off their world tour this past week in Los Angeles. Though it turns out tickets to see the legendary rock band may have been a tad overpriced, given that you could still get great seats right up until they took the stage. Tony nominations were handed out for the year's best work on Broadway. Once again, Michael and I were snubbed, shunned, if you will, but we'll tell you who wasn't. During Inside Baseball, we'll have a follow-up on our discussion last week of how Hollywood is dealing with China. Turns out major studios are finding it more taxing by the day. And if you stick around, you'll understand how that last sentence contained a pun and how my pointing it out right now doesn't make it the slightest bit funnier. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to Michael Giltz, entertainment journalist extraordinaire, who's going to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. I have the weekend box office for every movie around the world. And I think it's sort of a sea change, because in the last 2 weeks with Iron Man and its success overseas, I've seen every outlet covering the worldwide box office on this movie on opening weekend overseas and then again in North America. I think we may see a lot of other people starting to do what we're doing in ways large and small by paying more attention to the worldwide box office. Because the number one movie around the world this weekend is, of course, Iron Man 3. It grossed $351 million around the world, including the second highest debut in North America, right behind the Avengers. Its total worldwide is $680 million. I mean, it just came out in North America. It's only been out around the world for a blink of an eye. So it is barreling towards $1 billion worldwide easily.
Well, I like to call that chump change.
At number two around the world is The Croods, the animated film. It made another $21 million. It's at $520 million and counting. At number three is the Tom Cruise sci-fi flick Oblivion. That grossed $12 million. It's at $222 million and counting. At number four is Pain and Gain, the drama with Mark Wahlberg and Dwayne Johnson. $7.6 million is what it made. It's at $33 million and counting. At number five, The Big Wedding, the romantic comedy with Topher Grace. Another $6 million. It's at $16 million total worldwide. It's only open, of course, in North America. At number six, a movie that may never open overseas, is 42, the biopic about Jackie Robinson. It grossed another $6 million. It's at $78 million and counting. At number seven, Scary Movie 5. Scarily enough, it's still making a little money. It's at $5 million for a total of $51 million worldwide. And number eight is Les Profs, a French comedy. It's made $18 million worldwide so far, another $4 million this week. Nine is Olympus Has Fallen, another $3.6 million. 10 is Mud, which is an independent release in North America by the director of Shotgun Stories, and it's doing quite well. It made another $3.3 million this weekend, expanded wider, and it's at $6 million and counting. And then 11 is Evil Dead, another $3 million. And at 12 is an interesting film. This is Somos Dalhovens, which I don't know, but I'm going to guess is maybe means we are all young. Somebody please correct me. I'm sure I butchered that. It's a Brazilian music biopic about Renato Russo, who's a famed Brazilian rock musician, sort of their Morrissey. He was bisexual and he died of AIDS in 1996. And his various bands, including Electric Abortion, and I can't understand why they didn't break in North America, they sold millions of copies. According to one report, 20 million copies in Brazil, which is a monster amount of albums. But clearly, they're a very popular group. He is a very popular artist. And this biopic about his life is proving a big success in Brazil, where it opened to $2.5 million. And that's the weekend box office around the world.
You know, that reminds me of this bit that Jimmy Kimmel did on his show right after Coachella. He said, you know...
You watched Jimmy Kimmel?
Well, I actually watched the YouTube clip since that kind of went viral.
You're such a kid.
What? I'm sorry?
You're such a kid.
Well, what can I say?
Yeah.
You know, he sent a team out there and to India, where Coachella was happening. He said the kids at Coachella are so cool. They're listening to bands that haven't even formed yet. And so his team would ask these patrons as they're walking into the venue there, the Empire Polo Fields, hey, what do you think of? And they would say the name of some made up band. And all of these posers, I mean, attendees, would say, oh, I love them. I love their like, vibe is really great. And one of them was Obesity Epidemic. What do you think of the Obesity Epidemic? Are you excited to see them play? And the, you know, fans would say, oh, yeah, I can't wait to see them. I hope I can catch them.
It sounds like they were just being polite. I mean, there's 50, 60 acts there. over a weekend easily, right?
Yeah, I guess you have to see it. I'm not doing it justice.
All right, well, maybe Jimmy Kimmel wasn't doing it justice.
Well, I don't know. But so Iron Man, big hit. Did you see it?
I did.
Oh, that's right. You saw it in 3D.
I did. Not worth the money. If you go see it, please don't waste your money on 3D. See it in 2D. You know, like I said, it's better than 2, but not as good as 1.
That's true. And as the credits rolled on the film, the father sitting next to me was asked by his young son, probably under the age of 7, is this the last Iron Man movie? And the father said, the last Iron Man movie? Well, it's the latest Iron Man movie. I'm sure there'll be another.
Not necessarily with Robert Downey Jr.
Well, maybe
as
not.
The Hollywood Reporter stated, they estimated at one point that he would get $50 million from the Avengers because he had a clause in his Iron Man deal that if and when they made the Avengers movie, that he would get points. And he helped really launch this whole multi-character franchise. And he confirmed, of course, recently that that was true, that he did make that money, roughly speaking. He said, isn't that crazy? They're so pissed. I can't believe it. I'm what's known as a strategic cost. So he's getting a big paycheck. I'm sure he'll be back for the next Avengers. But whether he'll do any more Iron Man is sort of up in the air.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I found, you know, Iron Man 3 kind of has this voiceover at the beginning and end. And yeah. Shane Black wrote and directed it. Shane Black, who I believe...
Lethal Weapon?
I was going to say Lethal Weapon 1, and I wanted to say 2, but I don't know whether he wrote the second one. But he wrote and directed this. He wrote and directed Kiss Kiss Bang Bang with Robert Downey Jr. in it as well. And that opened in a similar fashion with a voiceover and closed with a voiceover, you know, Robert Downey Jr.'s voiceover. And I thought, wow, you know, kind of.
But luckily, nobody saw Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, so it didn't matter.
No, it didn't matter. But you know what? While watching this movie, I couldn't help but notice all of the product placement, specifically for Oracle Sun and Samsung and Rockstar, you know, energy drinks. And I mean, I could go on and on and on. It was so
blatant. You know, I mean, there's product placement, then there's just, what are you going to have them drinking? What are you going to have them? They've got to be on some computer and laptop. Either you make a generic fake one or you know.
Right.
You know, it didn't seem like it was egregious where like his t-shirt was touting product. It just seemed like, all right, they're drinking something. So that's what it was.
Yeah, that's true. I guess to me,
He did not write Lethal Weapon 2 or 3. He just got a credit for characters and story.
Ah, okay. I knew there was something going on.
Well,
there.
Story. So, but the screenplay was in fact by Jeffrey Boehm.
Ah, that's right. Okay. Well, Pain and Gain, you mentioned it's made $33 million. It's only opened here in the United States.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay. So, and 42, I'd like to point out, it's made $78 million for a baseball film. Not bad. It's only been in one country. $78 million, baseball film, one country. They should be happy.
But it probably won't be opened in any other country. Baseball doesn't play around the world. You would think, at least Cuba. But, you know, yeah, it cost, I think, $40 million to make. It's a period film. So it's not in the black yet. We'll have to see how it does. I hope they do release it overseas. It's plays well, a family film, inspirational story, etc. But, you know, that's where it's at right now. It's certainly, as far as you're right, as a baseball film, it's going to be one of the 10 or 15 highest grossing baseball films of all time, if you don't adjust for inflation. And if it keeps chugging along, it could get close to, you know, the $110, $115 million of A League of Their Own.
Well, Michael, you know what I wonder about 42 is whether it will actually be one of the 10 films at the end of the year, between 5 and 10 films that are nominated for Best Picture at the Academy Awards.
I would doubt it, but there's a smarter person than I who could speak to that.
You know, I think I might know who that person is. It is our resident expert, Ann Thompson, or I should say resident Oscar expert, Ann Thompson, who of course writes for IndieWire at the Thompson on Hollywood blog. And she is joining us now to talk about some of the changes that were announced at the Academy membership meeting over the weekend. Ann, thank you for joining us.
Always a pleasure.
So were you at this meeting over the weekend?
No. I was not allowed to be. I mean, I could have hovered outside, as I think the Hollywood Reporter did, sort of, you know, interviewing people on the street as they emerged. But it was an Academy-only meeting in Beverly Hills and at Pixar, where mostly it was the VFX branch and people like that, and in New York. And they actually almost filled up the Academy's Goldwyn Theater, and no one was allowed to bring a guest. I would have loved to have been inside that room.
Have they ever done this before?
Never. This is a first time only. And they've been doing sort of branch meetings. And apparently they realized that this was something that would go over very well. And it did, apparently, by all accounts.
Well, and the they in this case is Hawk Koch, who is the president of the Academy this year, at least for 1 year. He only has a one-year term. I think that's got to stop. I mean, you can't really get much done in 1 year. But
that had to do with how long his term as a governor was, sir. You can't be the president without being an active governor.
Oh, okay.
There's all sorts of arcane rules about this. So this was his last shot for the moment. I mean, I suppose years could go by and he could be a governor again, but they're limited terms. That's the deal.
So he decided to hold this membership meeting. You say they almost filled up the Samuel Goldwyn Theater.
Yeah, it's like 1,000 people, you know, almost in there. And various questions had been submitted beforehand, but they used the opportunity to make the announcement that this enormous rule change. Now, I had been going around like hawking people, you know, all of last year during the whole award season, because the documentary rule changes had been so successful. Just simplify it, you know?
Yeah.
Just take the screeners and send them to everybody and let them, you know, vote. And you know, there's nothing preventing that now. And so they did it with the shorts. But the only two categories that had remained off limits were foreign film and documentary feature short. So they added that because there had been apparently a lot of demand from the membership for this. And now, instead of this arcane system where you have to sign up and go to see a movie in a screening room, prove that you saw it, which limited incredibly and geographically limited to New York and LA, the number of people who could vote for foreign film. And now it'll be, I grant you, a more populist result, but I think that it's great.
And for documentary shorts in particular, on a practical level, it's such a great thing because these are tend to be 30 to 40 minutes long. So when you have to see four or five of them at a time, it's a real drag. So if you can space it out over a few days, that's a lot more appealing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. No, I think it's great. I think it's going to... Oh, it was also very interesting. Steve Pond, who I love. I love this guy because he's actually good at math. You know, he applied algebra to some of the numbers that Hawk Koch laid out about how 90% of the membership had voted and it was the highest turnout, and X percent had done the electronic ballots, which were done for the first time last year, although a lot of people complained about it. And then X percent used the ballots, the paper ballots. And so he did all the math and figured out that a third were using the online and two thirds were using the paper ballots, which I thought was interesting.
But that's a figure that I think over time will begin to change. And I
mean. But the, you know, anecdotally, you know, just seeing the entire Academy membership in one place did reveal, you know, without any question how old they really are.
With a lot of walkers.
Yeah. Well, I go to Academy screenings. Friends have brought me to Academy screenings a lot. And yeah, you know, that's the deal.
So I'm a little confused by the numbers. You're saying 90% of voters cast a ballot for the last Oscars. And of that 90%, so that total number of people, 87% of that number actually used electronic voting?
No, a third.
No, it isn't. No. I would send you to Steve Pond article so that he can explain how he figured it out, because he did all the math and figured it out.
Okay,
it was a third who actually did the online, and two thirds did the other one.
But two thirds also went out and purchased a computer. So,
well, Anne, you had a great comment talking about how these arcane rules that they've had in place are now being simplified, and that's great. But, however, some people who are experts at all those arcane rules may not benefit. Talk about that.
Well, Sony Pictures Classics is a good example one of the best specialty film distributors that specializes in foreign language films and actually has the ability to take them out theatrically and make them work. And we have applaud them for this, for their marketing expertise,
but
they also know how to game the system, you know, how to work it. And so it's going to throw all of the old verities into question, because it will no longer be such a small number of people who will be dictating the winner in the foreign film, especially in the foreign film category.
And you say it's going to be more populist, so a film like Amelie might win.
Or you could say that it's in their interest, or Kon-Tiki, something like that.
Right.
You could say that it would be in their interest, or be in their interest to have more movies open earlier and be seen by more people, as opposed to the sort of Sony, for example, would specialize in opening these films very late in the day, even into the nominating season in January or February, and putting them out, you know, then if that kind of release might not benefit this system.
Well,
so they're just going to have to learn, you know, they're going to have to adapt. Everybody does.
Right. And I guess we should mention that this is the voting process for the winners, not the nomination process.
Not the nominating process. And the nominating process is definitely, there was some complaints about that. That is something that I still feel is begging for reform.
What would you do?
They've got this very Mark Johnson, who loves foreign film and you know is trying to do the right thing. Over the years, they've sort of tried and adapted, because what happened was that they would, with the old with people, they had these different committees that would look at different numbers. This is where I'm hoping that they might. Here, there are a lot of problems with the foreign films because they're submitted by all the different countries. So there's no one has any control over what films are submitted. And maybe there's 64 films submitted from all over the world. If they could do what the documentary branch has done and get all of those screeners to the entire Academy, they could get rid of this arcane committee system. That was what was wrong with the documentaries before, was they had very small numbers of people voting on very small numbers of films inside each committee. And you could wind up with something like Hoop Dreams not getting nominated, or a great Thin Blue Line or something. So this is a question of trying to reform the foreign branch so that there aren't these, you know, committees, and then you have the bigger branch that's the whole Academy you can all participate in this if you see enough films, but then they have an uber committee that adds three films to the six films that have been put up by the larger nominating branch and group, and then you have this other committee at the very end that picks the final five. It's not good.
So the result would be that if you did send all the foreign film nominees to all the voters, they wouldn't watch most of them. And the movies that got released and actually seen by people and were perhaps popular and critical successes would tend to rise to the top more often than movies people have never heard of and barely get released.
That said, that was the fear with the documentary branch.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say, they did an incredibly good job of picking 15 films for the shortlist.
And they were
it was a superb list.
Yeah, they were all films that people saw and appreciated.
Yeah, exactly. They were the films that should have.
Some of them were really small. Some of them were films like Deetropia,
right,
or The Waiting Room, which was such a small first time feature doc filmmaker that it didn't get into most festivals. You know? So mm-hmm. So I was very proud of them.
And yet all these changes, and they're still doing some weird Dutch auction to figure out whether there's going to be between 5 and 10 nominees for
Apparently
Best Picture.
Apparently that's sticking.
They seem to like.
According to the reports, they reassure, I think it was the Hollywood Reporter, reporter asked Hawk, I think, and he said that's changing. I mean, that's not changing. That's staying the same. I hate it too.
Oh, I like it.
It's impossible to try and figure out or try and explain to somebody. And we've had people do it before, but it's just, it's kind of this
well,
weird.
Well, then you have to be good at math again.
Yeah, this, yeah.
In fact, I was having an argument over dinner with somebody who was trying to, I was trying to explain that if you have 9 films nominated for Best Picture with the system that exists today, as well as I understand the math of it, it means that there were a lot of people who liked those nine movies inside the Academy. It is an indicator that there were nine very popular movies, or they wouldn't have been nominated. And this person was like arguing with me about this, you know, and saying, "Oh no, people didn't like movies this year. They didn't like the films," and you know, so no one understands it. You're right.
Well, I think he's right to a point, because he's saying that there weren't one or two films that sucked up a lot of votes. The point of there's a wide open list of 8, 9, or 10 films, that means there were a lot of different movies that got solid support. In a year where there's one or two movies that seem like the clear front runners and everybody's crazy about them, they will get the vast majority of votes, and it will be harder for other films to reach that minimum level to get on the list. So there will always be five films. And the more spread out the favoritism is, the more movies there will be. If one or two movies...
How can you measure the difference between... I mean, if we don't know the actual numbers, how can you measure the difference between how many of those films... I mean, what if it was
Because they have to get, I think the number's 5% or what there's a right. level threshold. Right. So
oh, no, if we're not going to go down
this
road.
It gets 80% of the vote. There are more films that got the highest level in order to even get in.
Right. But if one
in a year where they don't like, in other words, we could look at another, in a year where they don't. Yeah, I see what you're saying. I think this means that there were many popular films, not that.
When there's no big front runner, the more movies that make it through, the less of a front runner there is, probably, unless it's one movie with 30% and everything else with 5%.
That's the thing. Yeah. Anyway, true. so that's going to stay the same. That's the bottom line.
Well, you know.
They made
we
good
can
changes
continue
as far
to
as...
debate it from here on.
Well, now we began the show by talking about a correction from CinemaCon that blurted out last week. And you had a panel discussion. You led a panel discussion at CinemaCon that was quite successful.
It was fun. I like doing those. Because you have an opportunity, the way it's set up, and Mitch Neuhauser did a really good job this year of putting together a group of people from different points of view, representing a studio head, Adam Fogelson, you know, the head of Carmike, the head of this other Digiplex, new representing the sort of new digital programming that you can do at Cineplexes, and a great producer, one of the great quality producers, Michael DeLuca. And then this guy from Matt Jacobson from Facebook.
Yeah, this little website. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Very involved now in the whole issue of social media and how you use social media. And of course, we can have this picture. I mean, one of the things that I find fascinating about CinemaCon is that the picture we have of what exhibitors are like, we kind of think of them as sort of Midwestern and pokey and forgive me, I mean, you know, old fashioned. That is no longer true. I mean, I get a kick out of talking to people like who was on my panel last year, Amy Miles, the head of Regal. I mean, this woman is brilliant business person. And to listen to the exhibitors talk about what they have to do, they're talking about computers and servers, and it's all digital now. And 35 is gone. And the battle for Windows is going strong and incredibly complicated is the word I would use. That battle is so essential to the entire movie industry, and it has no apparent solution. It's fascinating.
Yeah,
to me.
Well, and I think you're absolutely right. I think the other issue was, of course, promotion, and you know this issue of trailers being exhibitors like Amy Miles, who runs Regal, charging for space in the trailer pack. Before movies.
That's been going on for a while, but it's been sort of secret, right?
Right, exactly. It's nobody's really been mentioning it, but now, of course, people are saying, well, wait a second, why can't we charge studios for advertising their content, advertising their product? Studios would turn around and say, well, you're advertising the product that you will be selling, trying to get people back into your store.
And they were all fighting about the 3D glasses and who's going to pay for them as well. That whole question of 3D is sort of interesting, too, you know, how it peaked and then it sort of leveled out. And it's still a very constant and important aspect of how they all are making money with premium ticket prices. But it isn't the be-all end-all that they had hoped it would be.
Well, you're absolutely right in saying that, you know, people like Amy Miles, who, if you've ever heard her talk, she comes up and she's this kind of petite woman who you would just wouldn't expect to be the powerhouse that she is. And she talks with this Southern accent from Tennessee, and she's so
she's feminine in a way, but she's also tough as nails.
Exactly.
And she cuts through it. She's really smart.
She's like Baby Herman. You see this little baby. You like in Roger Rabbit. I saw Roger Rabbit recently. And you know, she seems to be this, you know, like you said, very feminine woman. And then all of a sudden it's like, whoa, wow, she's a tough
cookie. Like Holly Hunter in Broadcast News.
Okay. Very close. Very, yeah. Very apt. Yeah. Very good.
It's fine. Your real life person is probably a better analogy than my cartoon analogy.
But what was your big reveal? What were you starting out with from CinemaCon? I'm curious.
Well, I mean, it turned, you know, Cinema Exhibition was a logistics and human resource issue for decades. It was, you know, how many ushers do you have, a projectionist, and it was a real estate issue as well. That's what these exhibitors were really in the business of renting space or buying land and selling something on it. In this case, it just happened to be movies. And now it's turned into an IT problem. It's really all about information technology or, you know, technology and how to manage technology. And that's something that they had not, these exhibitors and cinema owners, they hadn't had to worry about that in decades, because it was the same technology that had been around for 50, 60, 70 years. Now it's all about the technology.
Yeah. But I think it's also about coming up to speed on the realities of marketing today as well, and that the exhibitors have to pick up their end of that bargain and be more aggressive about finding their local. Because the issue right now is all the competition for the people who are out there, getting them to come to the theater. That is what everybody's worried about. And you know, so far they've managed to do it, but they need to fight the good fight and picking up ways to pull people into the theaters locally is one answer to that question.
Right, and that's kind of why Facebook was on
exactly.
The panel. And I guess this was your panel was called "An Industry Think Tank 2.0: Meeting the Expectation of Today's Savvy Moviegoer." And I think you did a good job. It was an interesting panel. And I think it's even online. Somebody put it on YouTube. So we'll place a link to that in the show notes. Now, speaking of being online, you, of course, have a Twitter account. It is at AK Stanwyck. We'll place a link to that in the show notes as well. And Anne, it's always a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you for trying to unravel not only how Best Pictures are nominated at the Oscars, but what the changes are that were announced over the weekend to the voting process, not the nominating process, for a number of categories.
My pleasure.
Well, that was great of Anne to stop by.
Yeah,
despite the math problem that I gave her.
Yes, I think it's a math problem that nobody seems to understand. Or I should say, I have no idea what this math problem is.
However, the Stones are having a little math trouble of their own.
That is true. The Rolling Stones, that is, you know, this big
tickets available. Minus audience willing to pay price for tickets equals
lots of empty seats, I think. So Bob Lefsetz, who is this music industry pundit, wrote on his blog very early in the week that, you know, there were still lots of seats available to the Rolling Stones World Tour opener here in Los Angeles at the Staples Center. It holds about 18,000 people. It's where the Los Angeles Lakers and Los Angeles Clippers play. It's where the Los Angeles Kings play. It's a big arena.
And the Stones tour is looking like a disaster, to put it more appropriately.
Yes, pretty much, because he went through this whole process of explaining how you could still get tickets, really good tickets, right by the stage, just days beforehand. A week before, you could get eight seats together in desirable locations. And so I actually, you know, I had read the story about 5-6 days later. I went online and went to, you know, the Rolling Stones website and tried to purchase eight tickets, the best eight tickets I could get. I could have been 16 rows from the stage, eight tickets altogether. It was unreal. I could have been on the floor right outside the little tongue pit that they have, that little general admission tongue pit. It was remarkable. However, for the privilege of doing so, I would have paid $600 per ticket without fees. So getting two tickets would have cost me something like $1,300.
Okay, so let's put this in context. The Rolling Stones have always pushed the envelope on ticket prices. They've had like literally the most successful concert tour of all time at one point.
$500 million, yes.
They're a monster draw at the box office. They always have been. They've always charged a huge amount to see them in concert, and they've always been successful. And they started overseas, and they did very well overseas, and they've even sold out some shows in America. They had a couple shows at the O2 Arena in London, the Barclays Center in Brooklyn. They were in Newark, L.A. Every show sold out according to the box office data that I have. They have two big shows at Hyde Park in London that also did very well. The problem is that the Stones traditionally have played huge football arenas, massive stadiums so they could pack in 80,000 people. And now for this tour, they said, hey, we'll go to like intimate, quote unquote, venues, 10,000 to 15,000 seat venues, and we'll charge an arm and a leg because people get to be closer than ever. And what they didn't count on was the fact that people just aren't in the mood right now to pay that much money to go to a rock concert, especially for the Stones, who they've probably seen five times before.
Right, that's absolutely true. I remember seeing the Stones in 1989, and the big controversy then, and they were playing Shea Stadium, which is no longer around, out there in Queens by you, Michael, the tickets were $35. That was a big controversy at the time.
That's too much!
And people were saying, oh my gosh, you know, this is ridiculous prices. Well, lo and behold, 25 years later, they're charging, you know, how many more times? I mean, I'm bad at math, so...
So they're slashing prices. They're, you know, maybe having to renegotiate their guaranteed fees with some of the concert promoters. You know, they've been told, hey, no matter what, you're going to get $20 million for this or that. Now they're having to say, well, you know, maybe we'll renegotiate that. So they're, you know, taking action to try and make sure that they don't play to half-empty halls, because that would be an embarrassment.
Right. So, and I actually was wondering, I thought maybe I should just go down to the arena that day on Friday and buy a ticket, because there were all these $85 tickets, but they were behind the stage, way up in the rafters. You know, if they needed to change a light bulb, it was your responsibility to do so, those kinds of seats. and apparently, you know, they don't want to get in the habit of releasing thousands of seats at much, much cheaper prices right before the show, because then nobody will actually buy the tickets until the day of the show. So it looks like they released, you know, 1,000 or more $85 tickets in really good, you know, really good seats right before, you know, hours before the show.
Well, that kills scalpers, so that's not too bad. People who are scalping right there at the venue will lose money, or, you know, so that's good in a way. You know, lots of people would do it where they'd have a big sellout, but they'd hold back some seats so that there'd be tickets available the day of the show, and it would stomp down on scalpers who are actually physically there at the arena trying to sell their tickets.
Right.
I know that wasn't the case here, but that could have been a positive effect. Did you go to the show? I assume not.
I did not go to the show, no.
Yeah.
I mean,
right.
And you know what? I have to say that, you know, Bob Lessitz was saying, look, the people who like the Stones, they've got other priorities right now. They have children, or they've seen the Stones four or five times before, and $600 per ticket, that's a lot of money. That's the cost of two Coachella tickets for one ticket.
Yeah, they just outpriced themselves. And it's not surprising because they had so much success. I saw the same thing at Yankee Stadium. I've been tweeting about it and talking about it for a few days now with sports friends. At Yankee Stadium this season, the stadium is empty. Empty. 12,000, 15,000, maybe 20,000 people attending most games. That's half empty or worse. And the problem is, it's sort of a perfect storm. All the stars like Derek Jeter and Mark Teixeira and Alex Rodriguez, God help us, they're all injured. So there are no big names that are there. And they've been raising their ticket prices so much over the years, the last 3-4 years, that people think they can't afford tickets anymore. They're really expensive. And they also screwed out the fans who had, you know, mid-level packages, who used to get a lot of postseason tickets. They told them, never mind, everybody wants our tickets, we don't need you. And so a lot of people dropped their 30-game, 40-game packages. So now what you have, just like in the last 2-3 years, we've seen this happening, lower and lower actual attendance. You've got a stadium where their TV cameras are trying to avoid showing the fans in the seats, because there are so many empty seats around them.
Wow.
And that, you know, that makes for a bad game. You're not having fun. There's 12,000, 15,000 people. Hey, it's nice. I can spread out. I can put my bag down here. There's no crowding. But you don't get the noise. You don't get the excitement. You don't get the focus on the game. And in fact, the security people tell me that they have more trouble with a low attendance game than they do with a high attendance game. Because on a big game, there's a lot of energy and people are watching the game and focused on it. It's a lot more fun. And the Stones know the same thing. If you go to see them in a 10,000 seat arena and there's 3,000 seats empty, that's not a lot of fun.
No, not at all. I mean,
but
yeah.
Yeah. So one fun thing about this is that they didn't go with Ticketmaster. They went with another service, which you thought was pretty good.
Well, AEG, of course, Live Nation owns Ticketmaster, and AEG is Live Nation's competitor, so they're not going to use Ticketmaster. Although Ticketmaster did sell some of these seats, they kind of, sent people over. They got referral fees, I suppose. And they use a ticketing service called AXS, which is, AEG owns AXS. It's their ticketing software.
How did they get access to these venues? Because I thought a lot of these venues had, locked in deals with Ticketmaster.
Well, this is the reason that Live Nation purchased Ticketmaster, and that is, and vice versa, Ticketmaster and Live Nation merged, because AEG owns all these venues. So they own the Staples Center, thus allowing the Staples Center to use AXS, the ticketing provider, and not Ticketmaster. So now there's an alternative, and the alternative is there because AEG is saying, well, our venue that we own is going to use our ticketing seller that we own.
Well, it's not an alternative. You're locked in. Just like you are with Ticketmaster at one place, you got to use them for the other one. So it's just two sort of monopolies.
Right. Well, it's a duopoly.
Duopoly. So there's no venue that lets you just use the ticketing service of your choice, right? They all sort of have to choose
some
one.
Some do. Some do.
Do they?
Yes.
Okay.
Like, the smaller clubs.
So how did AXS work?
I have to say, I went and, was just experimenting to see what...
tickets were available.
Yeah, what tickets were available that I couldn't afford, which was apparently all of them. And, they were in great locations, and it was a much nicer experience than Ticketmaster. I mean, you could see the entire arena, and it was kind of in 3D, and you could click on the area that you wanted to sit, and it was really, really nice.
There's a certain advantage to starting from scratch today, isn't there?
Yes, and I think that's true of any technology system, any type of business process software or point-of-sale software like this. Anytime you start from scratch, you can avoid all of the legacy issues that that people don't like.
And yet, the New York Yankees screwed it up. They started their own ticket agency. That's another part of their big problem. They broke off from StubHub, which handles every other Major League Baseball team for resales of tickets.
That's right.
And they went with their own company, Ticket Exchange, and they screwed up everything. Everything is worse than it was on StubHub. Everything's more difficult, more onerous, more hard to figure out, bigger pain in the neck, and they charge you more money. They don't charge you more for the fee, but like if you want to email friends tickets, they charge you $2, $1 a ticket. And then that's it. They just, everything they did was stupid. It's like, did you not learn anything? At least copy what was being done and do it as good. But in fact, they did a horrible job with that. So you would think that would be what you could do, but even then, it's not always the case.
So how do you really feel about this Yankees ticketing situation?
I mean, well, it's sort of like all these different things that I love, like sports and music and theater. It's hard, as these ticket prices get out of control on Broadway. You want to go to a show on Friday night that's a hit popular show. It's going to be $200-$300 for a ticket. Well, thank God I review, because I can't pay that amount of money.
Well, it's funny because I can't go to any of those shows, and it has nothing to do with the price or that I don't review them. It's the fact that, I live in Los Angeles, and that's nowhere near Broadway. However, if you do get a chance to see some of these shows like Michael, some of these shows might actually be recognizable to you, especially if you live in London, where some of these shows premiered. The Tony nominations were announced last week, and some people got snubbed, like us, and some people were pleasantly surprised, like Tom Hanks. So, Michael, why don't you give us a rundown of who was nominated and what we can look forward to in June when the awards, the 67th annual Tony Awards, are handed out?
I certainly will. We've got a lot of box office news, of course. The Tom Hanks show, Lucky Guy, that was written by the late Nora Ephron, that just announced that it's gone into the black. It paid back all its money. It's been a blockbuster success since the second it opened. It could run for a year if Tom Hanks was willing to stay with the show, but they've already made their money back. It was only $3.6 million to capitalize that show. That's very low even for a play, I think,
Cast. CGI. It costs less these days. Yeah.
So that show's doing great. Whereas Alec Baldwin in Orphans, which was nominated for Best Revival of a Play, that just announced it's closing early. So that show was troubled with Mr. Transformers Shia LaBeouf bowing out, and then other Ben Foster stepping in, and now unfortunately it's closing early. So that's a shame for that. Alec Baldwin is a very good actor and a big draw on Broadway, so I'm sure he'll be back sometime soon. But we did get the Tony nominations.
Yes.
So that's very exciting. So, Sperling, I've seen every show except Lucky Guy, the Tom Hanks play about Mike McAleary, a newspaper columnist, and I have yet to see the Bette Midler play, which I'm going to see tomorrow night.
On Sue Mengers, I believe, correct?
Pardon me?
It's about Sue Mengers.
That's right. The play about the Broadway agent Sue Mengers. So I'm excited to see that, but I will not be able to see Lucky Guy. So it's a bummer because I've seen every other single show that's nominated. But in fact, you don't always have to see the shows in order to know who's going to win. So, of course, I have an opinion because I've seen them all. But let's see how you do, not knowing anything about the shows.
Okay, so up for here we go. I haven't seen any of – well, you go ahead, Michael.
Here we go. Here are the shows nominated for Best Musical. Bring It On, the musical, based on the film about cheerleaders. A Christmas Story, the musical, based on the film about a little boy who wants a BB gun. Kinky Boots, the film, based on the film about a man who wants women's shoes. And Matilda, the musical, based on the Roald Dahl novel. And, of course, I guess in a way, the film. So those are the four nominees for Best Musical. Sperling, who's going to win?
Matilda, the musical.
I think you're right, but it's going to be a close call. Matilda and Kinky Boots both got a ton of nominations. Matilda would have tied, probably, if the little girls had been eligible. But in fact, they decided to just give them a special Tony because there are four girls rotating the lead role of Matilda. So they both got, you know, they got 12, and then Kinky Boots got an extra one, 13, because their lead, one of their stars was nominated where Matilda lost out. So it's, you know, I think Matilda's the clear winner, and it's certainly what I would vote for, but there is a lot of love and support for Kinky Boots. I think Cyndi Lauper is definitely a lock to win Best Score.
Yeah.
If the guy who wrote the score for Matilda, who's Tim Minchin, if he wins Best Score, then I think it's unquestionable that Matilda will win Best Musical. So watch out for that early award. See who wins Best Score. If it's Cyndi Lauper, we got a horse race. If it's Tim Minchin, there's not a chance in hell that Matilda will lose for Best Musical. Now, what about Best Play, Sperling? The four plays nominated for Best Play are The Assembled Parties, Lucky Guy, the play with Tom Hanks, The Testament of Mary, starring the great Fiona Shaw, it's already closed, and Christopher Durang's comedy, Vanya and Sonia and Masha and Spike.
Okay, well, I did not know that that was by Christopher Durang, so I would say Lucky Guy is probably going to win, although Vanya and Sonia and Masha and Spike, I think it's between those two, but Lucky Guy is what I'll go with because of the Tom Hanks factor. And the Nora Ephron factor, she's passed away, so this play is being put on posthumously, so I think there's a bit of a nostalgia there.
Well, you're right, and I'm probably clouded by the fact that I've seen Vanya and Sonia, Masha and Spike, which I loved. I thought it was the best play of the year. Christopher Durang often delivers scathing comedies, but this one actually has a heart. It's moving, it's touching, it's his best play ever. He's been a fixture on Broadway for decades. He's created stuff like Sister, you know, Mary Ignatius Explains It All for You. That's been a staple in regional theater all over the country. So he's a real Broadway veteran. He's never won the Tony Award. This is the show where he deserves it. And darned if Nora Ephron might not steal it away from him. But I'm rooting for Vanya and Sonia. That's my pick, but I won't be surprised at all if you're right. Now, best actor in a play. We have Tom Hanks in Lucky Guy.
Don't go any further.
That's right. Well, I think you're right. Nathan Lane in The Nance, Tracy Letts in a revival of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, David Hyde Pierce, who's won Tonys before, in Vanya and Sonia and Masha and Spike, and Tom Sturridge in Orphans, which was a surprise slot that, you know, perhaps Alec Baldwin expected to get but did not. So you're picking Tom Hanks.
Yes.
Not even a question, right?
I think that that's a story issue. I think guy won two Oscars already, and, you know, he wants to, the only thing he's going to miss after this is a Grammy. So I think, they want to thank him for showing up at Broadway.
And he's interesting for different parts. He's won Oscars for certain movies, Emmys for producing miniseries along with Steven Spielberg, and now perhaps a Tony for acting in a new play. So that's a real, you know, what do you call it? Not triple crown, but four sweep of the Oscars, Tonys, Emmys, and Grammys. Lead actress in a play should be harder. The nominees are Laurie Metcalf in The Other Place, Holland Taylor in Anne, Christine Nielsen in Vanya and Sonia and Masha and Spike, Cicely Tyson in The Trip to Bountiful, and Amy Morton in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf.
This one is tough. I would have to go with Cicely Tyson, though.
She's adorable. She's 80-something years old. She's spunky.
Right. And I think just the mere fact that she's on stage is remarkable. But I'm picking her because she was married to one of the coolest cats around, and that is Miles Davis.
Not for briefly.
Briefly. Okay, fine.
Yeah, she was. I think she might steal it too, but I'm still going to root for Christine Nielsen. I think Christine will win because it's such a great performance. It's a showstopper. It's hilarious. It's touching. It's sad. It's everything. There's no question Cicely Tyson is just adorable. Both The Trip to Bountiful as a revival and Vanya and Sonia got a lot of love from Tony voters. So they like both these shows. Cicely Tyson got a nomination, as did other actors in her show. Three people from Vanya and Sonia got nominated. A lot of tech awards. So they like both of these shows a lot. But it's such a once-in-a-lifetime performance by Christine Nielsen. I think that slightly less love for The Trip to Bountiful. I think you're probably right, but I'm going to root for Christine.
Okay.
All right. So best actress in a musical. Oh, let's go to best revival. This will be the last two. Best revival of a musical. Cinderella, Pippin, The Mystery of Edwin Drood, or Annie. Three of them are playing right now on Broadway. The Mystery of Edwin Drood already closed.
Okay, I'm going to go with between Cinderella and Annie. I guess Annie?
It's between Cinderella and Pippin.
Oh, okay.
And I'm going to go with Cinderella. Okay. Though people who love the Stephen Schwartz musical love it, I couldn't stand it. I hated it. Hated it.
Okay.
And best revival of a play, Orphans, which just announced its closing. Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, which had a limited run, and as with every production of that play, got nominations for both lead actor and lead actress. The Trip to Bountiful, the revival of Horton Foote's play starring Cicely Tyson, and Golden Boy, a revival of a Clifford Odets play starring Seth Numerick.
Oh, I guess I'd have to go with, who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
I doubtful. It's probably between Trip to Bountiful and Golden Boy. Golden Boy got probably some of the best reviews of the year. I didn't love it. I wasn't crazy about it. It could be that somehow. I don't know. The Trip to Bountiful is still playing. It's heartwarming. Let's pretend they're Oscar voters and that they love their sentimentality. I'm going to vote for Trip to Bountiful.
Okay. Well, what do you think about lead actress in a musical? Well, or should I tell you first?
Sure.
I think lead actress in a musical goes to, I have no idea. How about this?
They're all perhaps first-time nominees, which is exciting. Stephanie J. Block for The Mystery of Edwin Drood. Carolee Carmello, nominated for the Kathy Lee Gifford musical, Scandalous, The Life and Trials of Amy Semple. So Amy Semple McPherson. So now Kathy Lee Gifford has created a Tony-nominated musical. Valicia Lakay is nominated for playing Diana Ross in Motown, the musical. Patina Miller, who was in Sister Act, is nominated for playing the role that Ben Vereen originated in Pippin. And Laura Osnes, who got her big break thanks to a TV reality show trying to cast Grease, is the lead in Rodgers and Hammerstein's Cinderella.
Well, I guess I'll go with Carolee Carmello.
Oh, my God, no. Not a chance in hell.
Okay.
No, it's going to be Laura Osnes, I think.
Okay.
She's going to win for, I think she's new Broadway royalty. They like the show. They gave a lot of nominations. I think she's going to win.
Okay.
So there we go. That's the Tony roundup. Spider-Man, we're on a death watch for Spider-Man. That's grossing just $1 million a week, and we think that's what it costs. It might cost $1.1 to $1.2 million a week to mount this show, because costs tend to rise as you go along in a run. It just gets a little bit more expensive. So right now, they may be losing $100,000 to $200,000 a week on the show when they don't make more than $1 million, and that's where they've been for a little bit now. They're only making 55% of their gross. They're at just 75% capacity, so one out of four seats are empty. This show could be in trouble. Meanwhile, Mamma Mia has decided to move to a smaller venue. They're being replaced by Rocky the Musical. And the big new shows could really use help. Lucky Guys, the breakout hit, and Motown the Musical, which is the show that was snubbed, perhaps, for Best Musical, though I don't think so because it's bad. That show is the big new hit of the season. That's going to run for a long time. People don't care about the reviews. They just want to hear the Motown hits.
Yeah, it's a jukebox musical, as you once called it.
That's the term, yes. It's even more appropriate for shows without a book. This one actually tells the story of Berry Gordy, hence the problem. It probably would have been better as a straightforward jukebox musical where they just had these talented performers recreate great Motown songs. I think that's what I would have preferred. Just Motown the review, the dream review we never got to see, where you have everyone from Little Michael Jackson to Diana Ross and the Supremes to Marvin Gaye to the Temptations and the Four. Just have a show where everybody's doing song after song after song. I think that would have been better entertainment for your money.
Well, if Spider-Man closes on Broadway, that would be huge news.
That would be a big deal.
Oh, I guess it would be a big deal. In fact, I bet it's time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story is about home entertainment sales, because every major studio will tell you that DVD sales have collapsed. I mean, they are broke. I tell you, broke. The facts tell a different story, however. In 2012, home entertainment profits, that's from the sale of and rental of DVDs and Blu-rays, video on demand, video streaming, digital sales, pay-per-view, and the like, it stabilized at about, you know, $18 billion. A fall from its heyday when everyone was building their own personal library of movies and TV shows, but still a huge chunk of change and bigger than their grosses at the box office, as is to be expected. As far as what studios actually receive from box office, home entertainment provided probably triple or three times the income, and now in the first quarter of 2013, home entertainment sales aren't just stable, they're rising, with huge increases in new areas. Sales rose 5% overall. Blu-ray sales, remember them? The area that collapsed increased 28%. DVDs, of course, continue to fall. Digital sell-through rose 51%. Rentals dropped by 12%. Another area of decline, but one that's being replaced by VOD, which is up 15%, by the way, and subscription streaming like Netflix is up 30%. Now, of course, the studios and the producers and content owners don't make as much off of Netflix, but that's another story. 60 million homes have at least one device that can play Blu-ray, and 112 million homes have a high-def TV. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. You know, they've stabilized the fall at a level that seems reasonable, and they've got a lot of areas of growth where it's easier than ever for people to rent or buy digital copies of movies. And frankly, the bandwidth wasn't there really a few years ago. So this is really the first chance to do that. And now they're making money. So their cries of wolf just don't pan out.
Well, yeah, and I would say that this whole Blu-ray increasing thing has to do with a couple of issues. One, the prices of Blu-rays dropping just a tad. But also,
Walmart has $5 Blu-rays.
Right, precisely. I also think that people like me who just never made the switch because why bother? We have a DVD player and it looks good enough. You know, once the DVD player breaks, you got to go out and buy another Blu-ray or, you know, another some form of media player. You buy a Blu-ray and they're like $99 now. So it's not the $1,500 or $400 or $200 it used to be.
Exactly.
So let's move on to the next story. The last of the major publishers is now making ebooks available to libraries. Hachette announced a deal on May 1st that the head of the New York Public Library trumpeted in a New York Times editorial. Every major publisher has varying quirks and twists to the arrangement. Hachette decided to make its entire ebook catalog available to libraries the day and date they go on sale. There will be no restrictions to lending, and the price is triple the list price. So a library might pay, say, $30 instead of $10 for an ebook, but they can loan it out, say, well, minus the two, well, forever, actually.
Until the standard changes.
Right. 1 year after publication, the purchase price is cut in half. With this deal, every major publisher is now on board with libraries in one way or another. And this is a quote. This step moves libraries closer to ensuring that patrons will be able to enjoy the same access to ebooks as they have to print books. And this was said by the ALA president, Maureen Sullivan. She continued to say, it also recognizes the critical role that libraries play in bringing authors and readers together in the digital age. So, Michael, big deal or big whoop? Or should I just speak for you and say it's a big deal and we can move on to the next story?
It's a very big deal. Somebody pointed out something I hadn't thought of. With digital access to ebooks, people who are homebound, elderly people, or frail, or physically challenged, or children who, you know, can't make trips to the library on their own, have easier access to new books via this way, which hadn't even occurred to me. But it's not always easy to get to the library. So, you know, it's not just a luxury for people who have expensive tablets. Tablets are now very cheap. E-readers are very cheap. Libraries are loaning out e-readers to people, which I hope they do more and more of. So it's access to books, which should be available to people in any format. That's something libraries have always done. It's a really important role. And I think ultimately they buy a lot of books and they create a lot of readers. So the publishers should work with them. I'm glad that's what Hachette did.
Well, now, you know, ABC canceled the soap operas All My Children and One Life to Live. Remember that?
I do.
Well, just because they didn't want to keep the shows around, it doesn't mean they want to see anyone else succeed with them either. New producers, Prospect Park, are relaunching the soaps, and, you know, they were online. They relaunched them April 29th, but they claim ABC has acted in bad faith and is doing everything it can to throw a monkey wrench into the transition. Better a monkey wrench than, say, a monkey pliers or monkey chainsaw.
Okay, true.
Okay. No? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, you would have been big on the borscht belt.
The borscht. If anything, I want. Well, never mind. They're suing. So Prospect Park is suing ABC for $25 million in damages. Among the allegations, ABC refuses to transfer the website addresses for the shows to Prospect Park. They've refused to consult on storylines, even though Prospect Park allowed characters to appear on ABC's General Hospital. And most damning of all, ABC killed off two One Life to Live characters on General Hospital by having their car drive off a cliff, which has never happened before in the
and
history
it never
of
survived.
Soap operas. Yeah, exactly. So big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop. It's petty. The launch has been quite successful. They got a lot of attention. They've been in the top one or two of the most popular TV series and stuff on online on Hulu and iTunes and other areas. So it'll be interesting to see how it pans out. This just seems very petty, though. And frankly, the network should be happy because with fewer soaps on the air, the ones that are left seem to be benefiting. General Hospital hit 18-month highs in key female demos and grew its total audience by 30% to 2.8 million viewers, the biggest increase of any show in daytime. So, you know, fewer soaps is turning out to be not a bad thing for the networks.
Well, speaking of popular TV shows, Glee has struggled in the ratings this season. It's been losing 50% or more of its huge American Idol lead-in now that the show is on Thursdays at 9 p.m. And fans and critics have all felt the show was, well, I guess tired, with students who already graduated from McKinley High. Is that how you pronounce it? McKinley High?
Yeah, you're right.
Spending more time at their old school than some of the teachers. In short, it was showing its age. Now, instead of canceling Glee, Fox has renewed it for not one, but two seasons. Creator Ryan Murphy hints they will probably move most of the storylines to New York City next year. No word on whether stars like Lea Michele and Darren Criss are trapped. We mean signed up for the new seasons yet. But is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal in the fact that it's so stupid. I wouldn't be surprised if they did one more season just to squeeze out what they could. But two seasons is unbelievable. I mean, it's dropping so much from Idol. They can't leave it on Thursdays at 9 and waste that valuable real estate. It would be a shame. I'm sure they're still doing well in the key demos. But this show has gone into free fall. The kids look creepy. They're hanging around their high school so much. It's like, go away.
They looked creepy at the very beginning of the show when you had like 30-year-olds playing 15-year-olds.
Yeah, creatively, it's dead. There's no question about that. I skipped through just to see some of the musical performances and see how they're doing. But the show's dead creatively. The idea that they're going to have two more years of this is just sad. I mean, the only thing sadder than Glee being renewed for two more years is seeing The Voice reruns on Sunday night from 7 to 9 p.m. That's astonishing to me. The most popular night of TV, and NBC has so few shows, they rerun a reality show. It's just, it's pathetic.
Well, now,
but why would they do it? Well, you know, they still pull in the young demos. They've sold 13 million albums worldwide and another 53 million digital tracks. So, you know, they're still making money in other areas other than, I guess, in the ratings.
Well, and, you know, pulling in the key demos, that is that's important. Just ask Jay Leno. And now, speaking of shows that I guess are, I don't know, musical shows, musical television shows, musical series. I don't know what you want to call them, but Smash, one of my favorite shows. And I don't say that in kidding around. I guess I kind of do say that kidding around, but I enjoy watching it. There's this big campaign to save it. And this week, Teresa Rebeck wrote, I think it was some a journalist on BuzzFeed. She said, if Teresa Rebeck was the problem with Smash, then why was the second season so much worse than the first season? Because of course, Teresa Rebeck, the creator of Smash, was kind of let go after the first season. And so it was very meta. She's like watching her own show and commenting on it.
That's bizarre. Is the second season worse? I stopped watching.
Well, it became more of a soap opera. Yeah, I mean,
seemed pretty soap opera-y at the time.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that it's any worse than the first season. You know, there's a campaign to save it. I don't think there's any hope for it at all. I think it's definitely going to be canceled.
No, it's not a chance in hell. The Revolution is coming back, and that's losing 60% of its lead-in. So, you know, they're just out of their mind. But again, they better not put that back Monday nights after The Voice, because that's you're throwing away a chance to build an actual hit, whereas Revolution and Glee on their own would collapse and fall apart.
Well, let's move on to comic book news, which we don't cover regularly. An independent comic book creator is being sued by Marvel and DC for trademark infringement. So what did he do? Did he create some fan fiction for Batman and publish it himself? Did he create a quote unquote new comic book superhero called Spider Boy or Spider Teen or Spider Dog or, you know, something like that instead of Spider Man. Nope. He created a comic book called A World Without Superheroes. And, you know, comic book publishers don't want anybody thinking about that. Well, that's it. That's all he did. The problem is that the word superhero is held in a joint trademark by Marvel and DC, and they're suing author Ray Felix to block his use of the word superhero. For 2 years, Felix has been waiting for a ruling from the trademark trial and appeals board. And this is a quote, "They're holding the word superhero hostage," Felix, a Bronx resident, told the New York Daily News. "It's an infringement on our First Amendment rights." Felix is 38 years old, is one of at least 35 people Marvel and DC have prevented from using the S word in the last decade. And this is another quote, "Superhero was first used in 1917 before either company existed," Felix commented. "The word is in the dictionary. It doesn't belong to anyone." So Jonathan Reichman, an attorney representing Marvel and DC, disagreed, saying, "We recognize that people can make reference to superheroes," Reichman said, "but when someone tries to trademark something that includes our client's brand name, it creates a sensitive issue." Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I find this fascinating. Forget the idea that they've trademarked superhero. Why not trademark hot dog? But how the heck did Marvel and DC come to an agreement to co-own the trademark of superhero? I would have loved to have been in on that negotiation.
Well,
I just find it's crazy that these two rivals actually got together and made peace so that they could make sure nobody else got to use the word superhero.
So it's a big deal then?
It is as far as copyright infringement and trademark and what should be, you know, public domain and what's fair use. Absolutely.
Well, let's stick with copyright for a second. Author Harper Lee avoids the spotlight whenever possible, but she can't avoid the legal system. The son-in-law of her literary agent reportedly coerced Lee into signing over her copyright for To Kill a Mockingbird a few years ago. Lee has asserted in court that she is going blind, suffered a stroke, and has no memory of doing so. She retrieved the copyright, but apparently the one-time agent is still collecting royalties, so Lee is back in court. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop. You know, they're sort of tidying up the ends of this suit that she's basically already won. Now she just has to make sure she gets her money. But it's amazing about the pull she has on imagination. I mean, I remember she once made the news for agreeing to judge an essay contest at a little middle school or high school or grade school somewhere. I mean, she does so few things in the public eye that anything she does is going to create a lot of attention.
Yeah, I mean, what I find interesting is that it's the son-in-law of a literary agent who I assume is deceased.
That's right. When as the agent was retired and then I believe died, more and more work went over to the son-in-law.
Right. With the son-in-law, not even like a blood relative, but the son-in-law who must, I don't know what he does, but,
well, he's a literary agent.
Oh, okay. Well,
you know, from my understanding.
Okay. Well, it's not very common for copyright to be assigned to a literary agent because it's a conflict of interest.
Exactly.
Well, here's a story that I assume is a big deal. Just a moment ago, YouTube was touting the fact that it has 1 billion unique monthly visitors. Now YouTube is back claiming that those viewers are watching 6 billion hours a month, or almost an hour for every person on the planet. Half of those videos are cat videos, and the other half parodies of Korean pop star Psy's Gangnam Style, but still, that's a lot of viewing, and I'm not watching that much, so there's a teenager out there, you know,
Picking up the slack.
Yeah. They also point out that aggregators like Vevo are the wave of the future, with major players like Time Warner and Discovery making big investments in companies that create, aggregate, or service content available via YouTube. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. I mean, it's just the place to go. You want to see a music video? That's where you go, YouTube. And the fact that these Vevo-style services are gaining momentum, I find kind of interesting, too. They want YouTube as the platform, but they want to create their own special environment to draw people in and get them to see their other product and other stuff that they want to sell.
That's right. Now, you know, people hate trailers, except the fact that they don't. Well, and here's what I mean. A new study reported in The Hollywood Reporter claims that half of Americans, and that's 49%, think movie trailers give away too much of the plot. 19% of those polled said knowing too much of the plot made them less likely to see the film. 24% said it made them more likely to see the film. Wait, what? In other words, 81% of those polled were indifferent or more likely to see a film if they learned most of the plot from a trailer. So, why? Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop.
No.
It's the article's a little confusing because they seem to say people hate trailers, but then they give numbers that say no. In fact, it makes people more likely to go to the movies. They may hate it, but it works. So, you know, I guess you could argue the studios wouldn't do it if it didn't work. But I have to believe that they made more artful trailers that didn't give away too many plot points, that they could still entertain, get across the idea of the movie, and not ruin it by showing 90% of the plot.
And, you know, during, and I can't believe I can't remember the name of this film. I'm having a senior moment here. Maybe I should be a part of the Academy. But the movie that was out during Christmas time, Naomi Watts was nominated for an Academy Award for it.
The Impossible.
The Impossible, thank you. Maybe because The Impossible is such a bad name for that movie, in my opinion. But so I saw that film in like October of last year. Then during the Christmas season was seeing a few films in theaters, and that trailer played almost every single time. And the trailer gives away the entire movie. I mean, they leave nothing to the imagination.
And the reunion, the finale, everything.
Yes. And so I sit through this trailer at one, I think it was before Zero Dark Thirty, and the people behind me say, I feel like I just watched that entire movie. And I'm thinking to myself, you are so right. You don't know how right you are.
And you know, what they don't talk about is with a good trailer, even if it doesn't reveal a lot of the movie or doesn't spoil half the plot, will that make people want to go to a movie? Of course it will. You know, a good trailer will bring people to the movie, and you don't have to ruin it for one out of five customers. Would the 24% who say they're more likely to go not go just because they didn't find out what the finale of the movie was? I don't think so. I don't think they say, gee, unless I know the entire plot in advance, I won't go. So they're missing the boat and how they parse these numbers.
Well, that kind of concludes Big Deal or Big Whoop and brings us along into Inside Baseball, which is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. I don't know how this particular story will affect our listeners other than the fact that the studios who create the content they watch are in a bit of a tiff with some folks in China. So this is kind of a follow-up to our Inside Baseball segment last week. And I guess maybe we should begin this segment with a quote from the story, the Wall Street Journal story, that came at the end of the story, and that was from a studio executive. The quote read, China's China, and there is always some issue.
It's Chinatown, Jake.
Yeah, forget it, Jake. It's China. I'm sure that's probably what they were going for. But, you know, I was kind of shocked, actually. This story in the Wall Street Journal was written by Ben Fritz, who, of course, used to work at the LA Times. And the LA Times has just had so many entertainment...
A brain drain.
Unbelievable. That entertainment department has been decimated. So now Ben Fritz is, you know, moved from the LA Times to the Wall Street Journal.
Good for him.
But that's not the story here. The story here is that China has decided to levy this value-added tax on, well, I guess the ticket sales. Box office grosses. Yeah, box office grosses. So they're saying, you know, yes, we cut this deal last year that brought the share, the percentage that we will give back to you, Hollywood studios, from, you know, usually between 13% and 17%, which is what it was before, to 25%. But now they're
saying, if a movie grosses $100 million, you would get back $25 million, which is the lowest in the world practically, but that's better than what they were getting before.
Correct. Yes. I mean, at this point, what they're doing with China is it's volume over the deal.
And now they've added a tax on top of that cut.
Right.
They said, oh, yeah, that's what you're going to get. But first, we want to add a tax to your grosses.
Right, precisely. And in many countries, the way this is done is the tax is removed before the split.
Right. So the real issue here is not, can China create this new tax on box office receipts? Of course they can. The real dispute with 20th Century Fox is over the distributor that they're working with. The distributor is saying, all right, we're going to split the movie's cost and then put the entire tax under your side. So if we owe $5 million in taxes, we're going to take it all out of your receipts, not ours. And that's what Fox is really fighting about.
Right. And so basically what they're saying is, so let me get this straight, okay? So you raised our share, our cut of the profits here, from 17% at most to 25% at most. However, this new value-added tax will reduce our take by 8%.
With one hand, they take, and the other hand, they give away.
Right. And
so 17 to 25, that's what, 8%?
Oh, yes. As a matter of fact, we're doing a lot of math on this episode. I don't know if you've noticed
that. Why not give them 50% and subtract 40% in taxes?
Yeah.
And then it could be back down to 10.
And by the way, this tax only applies to foreign films, all of which, previously there was a quota, 20 films per year from outside China could play in China. That, you know, this deal that raised the box office take from 17% to 25% also raised the quota from 20 films to 34 films. However,
they're all coming from Hollywood.
They're all coming from Hollywood. That
right,
is so correct.
And that's not a rule, right? I mean, England could conceivably have a film that wants to play in China and make it through. France could conceivably break through. But right now, of course, they want the biggest movies in the world, and those tend to be Hollywood.
Right, and they're outpacing, these Hollywood productions are outpacing gross-wise all of the Chinese productions. So the China Film Group, which is the only distributor in China, by the way, the only distributor allowed to put movies in movie theaters, is China Film Group. They have blackout dates where you can't release a foreign film.
Because they want their local product to do better.
Right, and there's also these moments where they kind of, the first big setback to this big deal that was cut by the MPAA, Chris Dodd over at the MPAA helped cut this deal last year, it was the fact that they released Batman against Spider-Man on the same day in China.
Them feed on each other.
Right, to try and dampen the box office take and allow some Chinese films to actually make some money.
Well, I think they wanted to get them out of the way, in a sense. Rather than having them compete with local product, put them out at the same time, they might make the same amount of money even, but at least they'd be out of the way, and then 4, 5, 6 weeks later, when a local film came out, there wouldn't be the same competition.
Right, and that's why, you know, there's so much talk about Chinese co-productions, because a Chinese co-production, the studio can take 40% of the box office take out.
Minus 8% in the tax.
But it's no longer a foreign film because it's a co-production. You see how that works there?
There you go.
The problem is none of these rules are written down. They're like all kind of, the rules just aren't clear. Nobody knows what the rules are because that's specifically the way this
and
particular...
They made this elaborate agreement and now they're reneging on a portion of it to a degree. And the way they're doing it accounting-wise makes it even more of a financial strain on the studio.
Right, because now 20th Century Fox, who is kind of up front in this battle... because of Life of Pi, they're saying, hey, you owe us $23 million based on the big whopping gross that was like 90-some-odd million dollars that it made in China. We don't want to accept the $23 million because if we accept the $23 million, then we accept the fact that you're taking out 8% or you're taking out a portion in taxes.
From all our side.
Correct.
Right.
So, and not a, the dual, you know, kind of. Where the value added tax
you take it out before they split it up,
right? So that's a bit of a problem, and all the other studios are kind of backing Fox, saying, "Look, if Fox accepts this, it'll set a precedent, and we don't want that at all."
That's Chinatown.
Yeah. Well, hey, yeah, that's true. Well, I guess that kind of wraps up Inside Baseball, unless you have anything else to say about it.
We're done.
Okay. Well, then let's. You know, this is listener email. I don't know. It's not really an email. I just wanted to thank Thomas Ajani, who is a listener who notified us that our podcast couldn't be downloaded through iTunes last week for, you know, part of the day on Wednesday. It turns out the issue was with our hosting provider, which stores and serves the podcast through, you know, through all the aggregators such as iTunes and Stitcher and the Zoom Marketplace. But I just wanted to thank him. We really appreciate listeners like Thomas reaching out to us and letting us know when there's a problem like that and giving us feedback. We really appreciate all the feedback you do send in. Now, Thomas, if you're interested in learning more about him, he has a film called Revenge on a Ghost that he directed. It's an independent film that he made on a shoestring budget over at Bright Sun Productions. His production company will place a link to it in the show notes. But Thomas, thank you very much. Of course, I just mentioned iTunes, the Zoom Marketplace, Stitcher. That is where you can subscribe or download our podcast. We do encourage you to subscribe and to rate and review the show at any one of the podcast aggregators that gives away our podcast for free. You can find links to all the stories we've discussed on today's episode on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find all those ways to follow us on Twitter, where our username is showbizsandbox, or you can like us on Facebook, where our page or our username is showbizsandbox as well. I'm detecting a trend here.
I am too.
In fact, you can email us. Guess what our email address is? dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Our phone number is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and it seems to be, kind of a trendy website these days. Michael, what is it?
It's letgleedie.com.
Ah, okay. Well, if you have trouble finding Michael's work on that website, you might want to try michaelgiltz.com. Some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. And until next week, play nice.